Hey everybody, welcome in. Thanks for being with us. My name is Barbara and we have a special guest for you today, Jim Payne. Jim's been with me on several programs through the years and he is one of my favorite people. Always something interesting to say and adventures to talk about. Jim is a former professor of political science at Yale University and Texas A&M University and a resident right here in Sandpoint, and he loves kayaking. He is a solo kayaker going long distances through wilderness terrain at times, and as I said, he does it alone. Today we're talking about his solo kayak trip through Holland and the book he wrote about this adventure, In Dutch Again. Okay, Holland is not wilderness exactly, but there were solo challenges galore, so stay with us. Go on this journey with Jim Payne. We'll be right back. All right, everyone, come on back in and say hello and welcome to author and Sandpoint neighbor, Jim Payne. Jim, thank you for being with us today.
It's a delight to be with you, Barbara.
All right. Well, I read and I loved your book, In Dutch Again, about your kayaking adventure in Holland. You have been kayaking this way since 1996.
Right.
How many trips have you taken?
On these long distance ones that have been written up, it's 14.
You know, that's amazing. And you know how I sincerely think it's amazing, because you do the paddling, you portage, you tent, you sleep in the rough. I mean, you're out there.
Right, right. Well, it makes you, as I've written, it all that effort, energy, worry, strain, makes you more attentive. For example, I can remember my kayak trips and what happened day by day very clearly, whereas a whole year might go by walking up and down the streets of Sandpoint,
And
you don't remember anything. So
right.
There's an argument for the stress and strain of travel.
All right. And the stress and strain of being alone, I think that's kind of the part that always astonishes me, that no matter, I mean, if something happened or happens, you're in it alone.
Yes, yes. And again, I've actually didn't start out with this principle, and I would ask people, hey, you want to go with me? And they didn't, which somewhat hurt my pride, but I ended up alone on all of these things. But as I look back on it, there are advantages. For example, you do make stupid mistakes by yourself. And there's a whole list of them there that can be very harmful or dangerous. But the interesting thing is they create challenges that are part of the story. In a way, you need, even I use the word accidents, to have adventure. If everything goes smoothly, the plane arrives on time, the stewardess gives you your lunch and so forth, then it's blah.
You know, that is a great concept, because it seems like what we point ourselves toward as some human beings, you and maybe others the exception, is we want everything to go smooth. We don't want the plane to be late. We don't want the luggage to be lost. We don't want to have to interact with the other passengers in some kind of an emergency situation. We don't want that.
Right, right. And that getting into this argument that we're suppressing about cell phones.
Yes, because that's another show. But
people
go ahead.
get them, they think, to prevent accidents, errors, and so forth. And I can give you examples of when they certainly did that, and it was very convenient. But accidents are also part of the excitement of life.
Exactly. Well, dipping into your book, I was interested, first of all, I haven't read all your books, obviously, but this one I really did enjoy, because it seemed like it showed me more of you. It seemed more personal. Maybe the others are just as, but on pages, you talked about why you kayak. I mean, what is it about kayaking that you really love, and why you chose to travel in a kayak? And the first thing you talked about is how at the beginning you were afraid of water.
Yes.
So
no, I'm not a keen fan of water and danger, waves and stuff. I don't like them. And that's why I'm not a whitewater kayaker. I don't want to be turned over, don't expect to be turned over, but I have been. But I think what happened, it's a personality trait that traces way back even to childhood. As a kid, I really was a kid, an excess kid, that I would do things strange ways, and this would puzzle adults and so forth, but I just wanted to push limits just to see what would happen. And that's what you're doing with a kayak. I mean, you can take an airplane from A to B, or you can kayak some kind of river and get to A and B. And for me, the idea of taking the river is very attractive.
The other part in this revelation of why you kayak I found interesting is, honestly, throughout this book, you are a people person. I mean, the people you met, people that you really, really enjoyed and liked and had time with. And yet, kayaking, not only solo, but kayaking is an individual, kind of a lonely process.
Yes, yes, yes. No, and that I discovered really, you might say, not by accident, by design. I did the Columbia, where starting at the Canadian border and Lake Roosevelt and all of that, that's very lonely. And I would go days and days and not hear the human voice. And I began to wonder, you know, did I know how to speak English anymore? And I felt this negative. And even when I'd come to a town, and this would be the modern, you know, 1970s, cinder block houses type stuff, I found that disappointing. And I felt a need for human connection and also history, culture. And so as I thought, what's my next kayak trip? I said, the oldest waterway in America, really, traveled waterway, is the Hudson River. Mm. And that's what I did, going up the Hudson.
You had more interaction.
Invited home, spent the night at people's homes twice, and so forth, and I enjoyed it. Yeah, so that's why I say I became or am a social kayaker. I want to bump into people and find out about things, and that turns out to be an accidental advantage of being alone, is you really connect with people. If you have someone else you're talking to and stuff, that starts to cut you off from other people.
Yeah, and you need to connect with people. You need a place to stay overnight.
Oh, yeah. Oh, to get you out of trouble.
To receive help and that. The other one, I think you may have touched on a little bit, but you mentioned how actually kayaking is not normal. It's unusual. I mean, it's an unusual mode of transportation, and you chose that. You wanted to get, I'm reading here now, the sense of adventure away from home and explore the wider world. And you wanted to do something unusual.
Right, right. I say it's the childish impulse in me of putting on your coat inside out just to see what it would be like, you know. And putting mustard on your ice cream or something like that. Really, that's what I'm tempted.
And how did that work out for you? Well, obviously, Jim, one of the advantages of your kayaking is that you are very physically fit. I mean, clearly, this is not an easy adventure that you go on. So I want you to talk to our audience about how the physicality of the whole thing is a part of the adventure.
Yes. Well, probably one of the biggest parts is the kayak itself. It's heavy. These are foldable kayaks that I've been using because they have to come apart and go in a backpack so you can go on airplanes and get around dams. And you can carry the long 12-foot, 14-foot thing through the city streets. So it's a backpack and heavy. And so that is a struggle. And as I got older, I had to stop more often and rest. And switch to the lightest possible kayak I could find, foldable kayak I could find. That helped. But even that was, with the stuff inside, was around 50-pound pack. So that it became...
Just the kayak was about 50 pounds. The whole gear.
Yeah, with the paddles. And you have a bit of a sleeping bag and things like that, tent packed in there. So the total...
Well, until I read your book, I had no idea there was such a thing, and I'll bet many of our listeners are right now feeling the same way, that there is such a thing as a collapsible, flexible,
foldable.
Kayak. And I think that I'm looking, the Feathercraft.
Yes.
Is Ultra that the light. One you use?
That's the second one. The first one I did was Klepper.
Okay.
And they are not to be confused with the inflatable kayaks, because the inflatable is kind of like a beach toy. It's too wide. I mean, I have one and I go out in it, but it's so wide. It won't turn over. That's great about it. It's almost like an inner tube. But it doesn't go well. You have to paddle very hard to get any progress. And of course, you have to pump it up every time.
Yeah. Kind of the difference between a pontoon boat and a boat with a prow.
Yeah.
I mean, an inner tube is clearly going to be, is going to be worse.
So the foldables, they will look at it from a distance. They will look like the hard-shelled narrow kayak and behave pretty much like them. And that's what you need to, if you're going to paddle, dozens of miles a day and so forth.
Yeah. I want people to hear this, that your pack weighed 50, a little over 50 pounds. That's your foldable kayak. That's gear, maybe tent, your paddles. I mean, 50 pounds, but this isn't just 50 pounds. This is 50 pounds that you're dragging up out of the water, up onto docks, maybe even up rocks. To get someplace.
Oh, yes. Well, when you go around.
This is a lot of struggle.
If you go around, many of the trips involve, in fact, almost all of them involve going around dams. So, yeah, you put it together, and they didn't make in most places, accommodation for a kayaker to go around. So, yeah, you have to struggle up some steep places and worry about one little twisted ankle and you're through.
All right. Well, let's get to Holland. This was not your first trip to Holland. You had been there before and you really enjoyed Holland. You really love it, don't you?
The first one, as I write about, I was, I have been at a traveler, adventurer kid. And when I got an exchange program to an English public school, after that year was over in England, I hitchhiked all around Europe on about 2 months from the top to the bottom to the top again, and went through Holland. And that's where my first experiences happened. And I recount how I tried to sleep in a park in Amsterdam and and a bizarre coincidence, a man looking for night-crawling worms to fish with the next day, bumped into me and took me home.
Yeah, because you weren't doing the right thing.
Well, yes.
You weren't behaving correctly, but his compassion and his good heart brought you in.
That was the first time I was in Dutch. The phrase, by the way, the younger people haven't heard it, but when we were kids, to be in Dutch meant to be doing the wrong thing and to be criticized by your elders.
To be in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here you are in your book, In Dutch Again. All right, everybody, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the things that Jim Payne loves about Holland, and you will enjoy this conversation. Jim Payne and his book, In Dutch Again. Hey, everybody, welcome back in. I am so glad you're with us today because we have a great guest, Jim Payne, and his book, In Dutch Again, all about his solo kayaking trip through Holland. And Jim, one of the things that struck me about your book is that you really enjoyed Holland. You really liked the people and the characteristics. So what are some of the things that you really loved about Holland and the people?
Yes, the book is maybe almost more about my love affair, as I say, with Holland and its culture than the actual paddling of kayaking, because I kept bumping into features of Dutch culture that they were subtle. That's the first point about it. It's subtle. It's almost, in many cases, where something doesn't happen that you expected it to happen, and then you think about, why didn't that happen? Just to take a small example, the Dutch bikes, I rented a bike, I spent a chapter on biking in Holland, and took a trip. And the Dutch bikes have all kinds of accessories that ours don't, or aspect, like fenders and chain guards, which really, when you think about it, are very important and necessary. But the one thing they didn't have was a rear view mirror, which I have on my bike and need. And I was wondering, why don't they do that? Was they hadn't thought of it and so forth. And I found when I would bike along, I'd be in the middle of the bike lane and somebody would come along and I'd hear a tinkle of their thing. Payne, you idiot, you got to keep to the right. And they are trained so well to be where they ought to be at the time they should be that they don't need the rearview mirror to tell them what's going on behind.
Because the one behind is taking responsibility,
right,
to alert you.
Yeah. But then the other aspect, which is so important, is that when I would be corrected, this is the other side of the being in Dutch, doing the wrong thing, which happened again and again, they did it so pleasantly that I wanted to do the right thing. And for instance, when they'd pass me by, they'd tinkle their bell, it'd be some, you know, young guy barreling along great speed and he had to slow down for me. He would smile at me and say, excuse me, something like that. And instead of saying, get over, you idiot, and so forth.
Right.
Which is the way we treat people that, you know, they have very good manners is almost too mild a form for it. Patience is maybe the word.
Yeah, heart kindness.
Yeah.
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 Going back to bicycles, first of all, can a person buy a Dutch bike in America today? I really loved it. It's got the fenders, the chain guard, the easy lock for your wheel spokes. It's just, why don't we do that here in the United States?
Yeah. Well, I've looked it up, and because I wanted at least the most important thing we can talk about is the low center bar, which
yes.
is absolutely...
The girl's bike.
Yeah, the girl's bike, which I always disparaged all my life until, long story short. But I think, figures approaching $3,000 that I saw on the internet for that complete Dutch-type bike.
U.S. made or made in Holland?
I don't know where they came from and so forth, but they're so rare over here that they just don't sell. I don't know what they'd cost if you bought them in Holland and shipped them over here. But they would be more than our bare bones mountain bikes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, $3,000. I'll have to give that some thought.
Get the low center bars. You can get
those. At least that. I would get that. So one of the other things that you enjoyed in Holland was their hospitality, which I think goes along with this kindness in their heart and their concern for others. Their hospitality was amazing.
Yes. Although I wouldn't say, again, they're prudent. They're also quite prudent and thoughtful. If you were a drunk wandering down the street, they wouldn't say, yeah, come home and have some more to drink.
No.
That's very un-Dutch. They're assessing who you are and so forth and what's the appropriate thing to do in each case. But the gentle correction, one example that just fixes in my mind coming back on the train, a whole bunch of us English-speaking travelers, but from different countries, were raucously exchanging our stories about our trips in the train. And then the woman, she was English, next to me, bumped my shoulder and said, I think we're making too much noise. And I looked up, and down the aisle, there was a Dutch woman with her laptop out and so forth, looking at me, and pointed her finger up at the sign above her head, which said, quiet car, no conversation in English as well as in Dutch. I said, oh my God, you know, how rude can you be? This is a car for executives to work quietly. And we're, you know, like a bunch of drunks in a tavern. But the interesting thing was she was smiling. She was happier than we were.
Just pointed yeah. to the sign.
She was, yeah, it wasn't like she was angry at us. She was our mother saying, I know you're kids and you haven't grown up yet. And that's what, how I say, was constantly happening.
How about the Dutch creativity that I think I saw that was also nuanced and, but, you know, playful?
Yes, yes. And but subtle. This is
subtle.
We think of creative, like if you were saying, oh, I'm going to make a famous painting, it would be big and splashy colors and so forth. But what they do creatively is kind of subtle in different ways. And many times you'll just be walking, just one in a window of, it was, I guess, a craft shop, but this fellow had obviously spent years recreating, these would be cars, like sports cars, that had been left out, as they would look, left out in the farmyard for 20 years. In other words, totally old, broken down, but the paint had been, paint and insects and dents and all that, so that the car, looked like it had been there for 25 years with all the dust and grime on it. And, you know, all the effort spent, months, to create that effect of the old car and so forth. And it was just in a little shop window in a little village alongside something. That's what's happening all the time in Holland.
Yeah, and they have fun with their signs that they do. They put in English also, but they have fun, that kind of a creative way of communicating.
Well,
we would just say this is this or this is that.
That's the playing. Well, they're playing with English, the foreign language. They play games with English. Now, their Dutch is their language, right? So they're playing a second game. So, yeah, you'll see all kinds of wisecracks in English on the signs, like names of store. Lady Licious, for example, was the name of a woman's clothing store. Okay. Now, imagine doing that. Americans using French or something and taking part of it. I mean, we wouldn't even know how to begin.
We wouldn't know how to begin, and we wouldn't think that way either. The other part of the book that I'm interested in hearing you comment on is, and it would be the part that I would be the most interested if I were there with you, it would be less on the paddling and the kayaking, Jim, and more on the, let's spend a couple of days exploring this town and museums. And that was a big part of what you really enjoyed in Holland. Exploring the communities or the cities that you stayed in.
Yes, definitely. And as I say, the people are extremely cooperative and also very interested in other people. And another thing about them, I would say on a per capita basis, there are more tourists, Holland, that have been abroad touring than probably any other country in the world.
Say that again, that people come to Holland.
Bump into a farmer out in his field, and this happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been to Canada, he's been to Thailand.
Okay.
This is a farmer.
They are travelers.
They are world travelers. They love to do that. And that's one reason why they've been to the United States, of course, and so they like to share their experiences.
And probably why maybe their English is not only, it's so good, they can be playful with it and creative with it. They speak English.
Oh, yes. Well, that's the grounding of
lingua
why
franca.
I went there.
Yeah.
Is being a social kayaker, as I say, I've got to chat with people and find out about the culture, and they are just very good English.
You know, so you visit in the communities churches and museums and art galleries and parks and, you know, other things. Do you, what do you purchase over there and have shipped home? Anything? Do you buy things that you just have to have and ship at home?
Well, just to show you an example of the creativity, it's still outside in front of our walk. You can walk by and see it because it's still working after about 3-4 years now. It is a a solar-powered butterfly is the way to describe it. How the guy achieved it, the inventor, and it sticks in a shaft, and you put it in your garden, and on a tiny little wire, there's a tiny little motor driven by the sun solar power, so that this thing jerks and flies around in a kind of jerky circle in your garden. I say, they're very clever.
Yes, and fun. I think it's the fun part of it.
Yeah, yeah. There's a smiling, but not a raucous laughter.
Right.
Like a double take or triple take type of laughter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, of course, I'm assuming everybody knows, I was at Trinity yesterday for lunch, and I have to confess, a root burger. It was a beet burger. It wasn't meat. But anyway, the cheese on it was Gouda cheese, and I guess they pronounce it Gouda cheese. I don't know. But it's so delicious. So you don't send home a cheese from Holland? Or?
Well, I guess part of the answer is I travel light. Very, yes. Very, very light. I'm wearing the one shirt I have, which I know you frown, but
wow.
I will occasionally wash it if I'm in a bed and breakfast. I'll wash it at night and it'll be dry by morning.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm not that terrible, but
yes.
It's not too good. But the one thing I did bring... I very late at night heard a choir singing in the cathedral and went in, and I was the only person. The door slammed behind me, and the director turned, and because she had stopped, and said, "Yes, may I help you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from America. I sing in my choir too." And she said, "Oh, come up here and sing with us." So I became part of the choir rehearsal, and afterwards she gave me, which she gives all our choir member, this was in Dutch, and I can't give you the Dutch, but the translation of it was a placard which has cartoon figures singing that says, "I don't need therapy, I sing in a choir." That I wrapped carefully and packed day after day after day and brought home, and it's in the, you can go to the First Lutheran Church choir loft and see it there.
I love it. You actually put it in your pack and carried it home? You didn't ship it home?
Right. No, shipping it, that's complicated,
okay.
I guess. Yeah.
Just wrap it and
carry
it. I never
have done. Yeah.
Well, you carry your kayak and your one shirt. Why not carry the sign home?
I can slip that in.
I love kind of this is a simple life that you lead, isn't it?
You're
a complicated person. You've written, what, over 22 books?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Lost count.
Yeah. And so this life that you're describing, this trip that you're describing is in its simplest form that
yes.
you can make it.
Yes, and I find simplicity is... somehow, how should I say, it frees you up to do other, to give you one example. When I first, the first big long distance trip was down the Columbia, I got myself a gas-powered stove, okay, so that I could cook a meal at night and so forth. And I found that whole thing took about an hour and a half to take that thing out, set it up, unpack, and then cleaning up all of that stuff. So there was an hour and a half, you know, and I got tired of that and just set it aside. And the rest of all my kayak trips, it's just energy bars, nuts, dried fruit, and bread and peanut butter for a peanut butter sandwich and jelly. And that's it.
And when things go well with people that you meet, maybe some hospitality in their home for a hot cook meal from time to time, but not
right.
to carry a cooking stove.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. you can live without a hot cup of coffee. You really can.
I know.
So.
Especially if you're out in the woods.
I don't know. But I say it gives you time to do other things.
Yeah, and meet people and do other things. I love that. I don't need therapy because I sing in a choir. I missed seeing you at the recent Pondere chorale and orchestra concert that they had. I went to in June, and I talked to Mark Reiner and had interviewed Mark, and I told him about your sign, and he said that you had called him about, you know, I don't need therapy because I sing in a choir. And do you think that you'll be singing tenor again for the Christmas program?
I sang on, it's a complicated story. I sang on Friday.
Oh, okay.
And through a complex thing, I had agreed to play duplicate bridge many months before I knew there was this Sunday performance.
Okay.
And this was in Spokane and so forth. So okay. It was a prior obligation situation.
I missed you.
I feel terrible about it.
But. I never, somebody took your part or somebody stepped up and they could sing both, I guess. I don't know.
Well, the one tenor there did a brilliant job filling in for actually two of us that had to miss for various reasons.
Excellent. All right. We are going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to have more conversation with Jim Payne all about, well, him, his life, and his book In Dutch Again. Hey, everybody. Welcome in. We are talking today with Jim Payne and all about his kayaking, his solo kayaking trip to Holland, titled In Dutch Again. And Jim, all of your books, are they all still in print?
Yes.
The political books and the kayaking books?
There are five kayaking books that encapsulate these 14 trips. And they're all the same dimensions, so they can be in one gift package for somebody.
So these are available probably by order at Vanderford's, and they're available on Amazon?
They're available on Amazon, they're available at Vanderford's, but they're available, the best and cheapest, by the way, because I put a higher price on them for Amazon, is Litton Publishing, my own publishing company. And there's a website, littonpublishing.com.
littonpublishing.com. Yeah.
And there's my daughter maintains that website, and she's built it and everything, and has more information than you'll ever need about the books.
You know, you probably, ladies and gentlemen, won't be able to write all this down. You can find this at Lytton, littonpublishing.com. But one of the books is One Inch Above the Water. That was published in 2008. Discovering England is another one. Worlds to Discover came out in 2015. And Chasing Thoreau, which is one that I'm interested in now that I've seen that title, was published in 2017. And, of course, the book we're talking about right now, In Dutch Again. Lots of wonderful books, especially for those of you who are kayakers or, like me, kind of an armchair kayaker just enjoying the adventure with Jim while he goes and packs all that stuff all over Holland. I get to go to Holland with you, so I kind of like that.
Right. It's travel adventure.
Exactly. One of the things that you noticed was a difference in the attitude in Holland to their history. For example, the way they go back and look at World War II issues and the way in America now we are looking at history.
Yes. Well, it was a very emotional moment for me, as I was hiking through this is along the Isel River. You'll find these German pillboxes. These are big circular concrete things about 15 feet in diameter, where the Germans would have their machine guns, and they were to resist the counter-invasion of the Allies. I came across those, and what surprised me about them is they were totally untouched and ignored. And frankly, this made me angry because this is the Nazi Germany's invasion of Holland, which was just so terrible, so appalling, you know, 100 times worse even than the Russian thing of Ukraine.
Unnecessarily brutal.
Well, just unnecessary, brutal, and so forth.
Yeah.
From beginning to end, they captured Holland people and put them in forced labor camps and stuff like that, and of course searched the Jews and various Dutch people, protected Jews in the attic. This is Corrie ten Boom, if you've read her book. protecting the juice. So anyway, a really horrible wrong. And for me, this is kind of with my American mentality, saying, how can they let this symbol of German horror just sit there here in the blackberries and thistles and so forth and ignore it? And I, if I lived there, anywhere near there, I wouldn't be able to ignore it. I would feel it ought to be either blown up and carted away, or maybe we'd make a big park out of it and have a big sign saying, this is terrible what they do and must never happen again, blah, 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 blah. And I sensed, however, thinking about it and stuff, that the Dutch are beyond this and more mature, more adult, more advanced or whatever, that this type of looking back, I mean, it takes dynamite to blow up. Okay, why spend the time on, do some good to the world, do something constructive, creative. In other words, and that's the way they are. They're not backward looking and fist shaking about the past, that which we say we're so entangled in these days. When you can't change something in the past, it's different if it's still happening in this. Yes, but if it's all over and done with, then turn away and do creative, constructive things with your time.
Yes, don't go back and try to rewrite history. Yeah. Let history, it speaks for itself.
You
it
can
is,
go back and read history and it know, is we what know it is. About what it is.
You can go look at a pillbox and know what it is. Yeah. I saw them in, as we were talking on the break in Normandy.
Yeah.
But why try to change it? Because that was the reality.
Yeah.
So don't spend energy and time on changing it. Just there it is.
Yeah.
I agree. Photos. You know, you didn't have any pictures in your book. I wanted at least a few pictures, but...
I did. Well, I have the two that I got in black and white in there.
Oh, yes.
One is the road sign that was an interesting sort of a lover's one gasp or something where the 100 things Holland is perfect in, the one thing they are not is... They're leaving the city signs, which is, I still can't, and I've talked to Holland friends, and they're actually, I think, starting something, and they're maybe going to change this. But what they use is a big red line across the name of the city. That's, so you, it's leaving, like if it's Smithville, it would be a red line across the word Smithville.
What's their intent in doing that?
Well, no, that accomplishes the idea. It gets the job done.
You're getting out of town.
Yeah, you're, it's the end of the jurisdiction. But they do have the problem that since it's a multilingual society, how do you say that in more than one language?
Mm-hmm.
So they're bypassing language and just doing that. But it leaves a bad taste. And I'm proposing that they have a national contest and have some way of, doing it without words, but indicating you were leaving the city. That is in a tune with all the rest of Holland's.
How about one of those creative solar-powered hand waving bye-bye?
Fine. Here we can say anyway, this is bureaucracy at work. It's the
as opposed to the people's creativity.
It's the state bureaucracy that's decided to put up these signs.
A couple of questions for you, because what really came across in this book is how much you enjoyed Holland and being there again and the people. First of all, if you could live in Holland, would you go live in Holland? Would that be something that you could do?
Yes. I say I'm happy in Sandpoint and stuff. But, I would like to study the culture more deeply because it's subtle. It's not out in front. It's almost the things that are not done, like that pillbox.
Yes.
It was that it was not destroyed. It was not touched. Nothing was made of it.
No big museum, big sign, never again.
And many other things, it's things that don't happen that are so significant. So... You have to be subtle about it and spend more time there chatting with people and visiting and so forth.
You know, this is a difficult one, but I'm going to ask it anyway because of the 100 things you love. What was maybe your best experience or the one that was the most memorable or profound for you on this trip?
Wow, yes, they all were. Yeah. Well, the one, it's funny that, because it happened so, on my first day, I started at a houseboat. It turned out I found a houseboat that was a bed and breakfast. So I could set up my kayak the day before on the edge to the deck of this houseboat. And I was spent several days. This was in Arnhem. I was chatting with the owner on the second day. And he said, now, you know where you're going to be tomorrow. And I said, well, no, because my style of travel is to, you know, come as may and let things happen. And you have bad things happen and so forth. I was in Dutch. He was saying, what? You know, you've got to have a cell phone. You've got to call people. You've got to arrange your lodgings and so forth. And I mean, he wasn't angry, but he was stern about it. Dutch uncle. And I said, well, gee, yeah, you know. And he said, maybe you're going to have to sleep out in the field if you don't get a place. Anyway, he came in the next afternoon and he said, I've been on the phone to this was Deventer where I was going, and I've set up a bed and breakfast for you. And I said, oh, thank you so much. So there was another case. I was in Dutch. I was doing the wrong thing. I wasn't taking care of myself properly and carefully, and he stepped in to help me with good-natured way that they are.
I love your book because it helped me fall in love with the Dutch people too. Jim Payne, thank you so much for going to Holland and doing this trip and writing your book about it.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you for being with us. And hey, everybody, thank you for being with us too today. Come on back next week. That's Tuesday, July 12th, because Lieutenant Doug McGeechee, who is in charge of the Bonner County Sheriff Marine Division, will be my guest. We're talking about all things required or not allowed on our waterways and lakes, rivers, watercraft, paddleboards, kayaks. Until then, this is Barbara saying take care and may God greatly bless you.